Okay. All right. I'll intro and then we'll get into the conversation. Well, thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston. I'm Whitney Powers and I'm your host today for the series Small Talks, Big Ideas, which is a weekly half hour plus or minus show that is a collaborative space shared by four of our community's advocacy organizations, including Low Country Local First, the Coastal Conservation League, the Sustainability Institute, and I'm If You Were Mayor. While these organizations serve different needs in our community, they are largely aligned in their vision for the future. So Small Talks, Big Ideas is a space for each of these organizations to share their ideas, have tough but necessary conversations, and invite you as listeners into our work. And for today's segment, we welcome Kat Morgan, who's the chief head honcho and thoughtful provoker behind Changeability Solutions, with the strategy of helping people and business owners create positive change for themselves, their businesses, or organizations in the world. Big, that's a tall order on the mission statement. She's a bit of a celebrity these days. She was a much lauded speaker at this year's TEDx Charleston. I heard about it constantly for many days following that event, and I actually heard you as part of the Low Country Local First Good Business Summit. You were on a panel about diversity. And so if I read you in my sort of nominal way, if I read you, maybe I would say that your interests are kind of at the intersection of ideas and how we make change by capitalizing on our differences. And I also just want to thank you for being here, and would like to think of our conversation today maybe along the lines in terms of how this program has kind of evolved, along the lines of how we individually have the capacity to cultivate community. And because a lot of what we've talked about are kind of more big organizational kinds of themes, and we haven't had a lot of conversations. I think Jeremy Rutledge was one conversation that we had with that kind of keyed in on how we individually can contribute to that. I mean, it certainly can segue into organizations and things, but we've been a little reticent to scrutinize individual culpability in this effort. We've had terrific conversations, and so I'd just like to think about questions that we might ask ourselves maybe today in light of the recent presidential election, some of the atmosphere around the trials that Michael Slager trial, the Dylann Roof trial, and how we might be thinking about issues of race, gender, authority, trust, when we're faced with the media circus. I mean, seems real sort of, I would say turn off Twitter maybe. But why don't you, I'd just like, first of all, to ask if you might introduce yourself and a little bit about how you've come to this place of change in your life's journey, a little of what is Changeability Solutions. I know that you have a bit of a cold, and so your voice is probably not what some people may recognize, so they'll just have to bear with you.
You're right, thanks. So I'm Kat Morgan, and introducing myself is always an interesting thing because when you started talking about the show, I started thinking about how I connected with some of the themes, and then when you started talking about the individual action, I shifted in my head about how did I want to introduce myself, and I always find that really interesting that the context shapes how we show up in the world, and I think that's actually how I'll introduce myself, which is, I think the context I'm in right now is really shaping what I feel called to do. And I know for a lot of folks here in Charleston, after Walter Scott was killed, but I think even more so for white folks after the Emanuel massacre, there were a lot of white folks who started saying, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do to make a difference? And how did this happen? Why did this happen? How could this happen? And I feel like that was a question that I asked as well, but from, I think, a different place from some of the folks I ended up talking to. And for me, it was because I feel like I'm always in the present, but also seeing how what we're dealing with today came from the past, because I was raised by an historian. And I'm always seeing that. I'm always seeing how what I'm experiencing today, what I'm benefiting from, what I'm struggling with, is all shaped by people who came before me, things I did in response or didn't do in response, and that the future is created right now. So what I do right now is how I shape and change and shape change, really. I don't know if that's a introduction or not.
I think that's great. I mean, I hope that doesn't mean we're reliving the past. Seems somewhat appropriate in Charleston, I suppose. But but it does mean the notion of being informed by the past. Reasonably informed by the past, I think, is important. And that's a past that's probably a totality of the past and not a mythological past or
yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, my dad had a button that said, those who, Historian Association put these out, and others wore them as well, but it meant something to me knowing that he was wearing it as part of a professional association of historians, and it was those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
Oh, right, sure.
And so he talked a lot about how we can learn what didn't work. Not that you can't repeat things that you didn't succeed with in the past and they won't succeed in the future, but really that we can learn from the past. So it's about knowing that right now we have a choice.
Right.
And we can't change the past, but we can change history, because history is the story we tell about the past. So we can change what our future will look like, make it different from today, make it different from the past, simply by making a different choice this time. And we're presented with choices in every moment, every single moment. I might not feel like I'm choosing what I'm going to say right now, but I am.
Right.
I'm making a choice. And I think sometimes mindfulness is so critical, because that's where we start paying attention to where am I right now and where do I want to be. But there's a choice moment with each word. And I think that's critical. And that's not necessarily something that we talk a lot about. You know, that how do you choose to show up? It's a conscious effort every single day. But we don't often, I think, stop and think about what would happen if I made a different choice. What would happen if I said something or didn't say something or paused?
Right. You know, it's an interesting thing. I think doesn't the Jewish tradition have a holiday where you think back over the year if those people that you've slighted or
the days of awe
and you know, there's obviously this time of year that the Christmas, the movie, this Your Wonderful Life or whatever, and there's the what if I had made a different decision about rescuing the the brother. And I think it's a valuable point. You know, it's sort of, I think mindful is a really nice word to sort of use in that context. So I'm going to jump a little bit right into some things. We're going to jump right into some things. Diversity seems to have gotten a bad rap lately. We've been hearing it sort of assigned a negative connotation, while those of us who live in more urbanized areas really think of diversity as a kind of the heart of creativity and mindfulness and knowing kind of cooperative collaboration, those kinds of things. And I guess one of the questions that sort of comes to mind is are white people intimidated by the concept of diversity? I'm reading Zadie Smith's book Swing Time, and there's a point in that book where she talks about white people are just white people, but black and brown people are from all kinds of places, and they have all different the diversity of brown and black is really vast, And which I found this to be an incredibly interesting observation. And so I guess that the question of, you know, looking at diversity as a really good thing. And is that something you maybe speak to? I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The first thing you said right off the bat, I think you're right. The word diversity is a buzzword. It's gotten a bad rap from a lot of folks for a lot of reasons. I think when I think about it in work and with clients or with organizations I worked in, a lot of times what that was code for was, uh-oh, somebody said something disrespectful, racist, insensitive, sexist. Uh-oh, you know, we're in trouble, or we could get in trouble, or they're in trouble, or we're going to have to do a diversity training. Almost like the diversity training was a punishment or a way to shield the organization from legal challenges, which then creates a lot of defensiveness just from the get-go. And the other thing I saw a lot is there'd be a two-hour diversity workshop. I don't know if you've ever been to one of these, but I've seen them online. I've participated in them, where the two-hour diversity workshop, and it's a checkbox workshop. It's right. We have to comply. It's a compliance. So I called those CYA workshops. and they weren't about change, and they weren't about creating safety or trust or really getting to something useful or helping people understand the value they added or the value other people added or the value of difference. And so I think the whole word became problematic. And then more recently, the word inclusion has been what people talk about. And so now you'll even see people will talk about themselves doing D&I, you know, diversity and inclusion work. And the word inclusion, I think, is a really powerful word as well, but it's also now become more of a buzzword. And when I take both of those words out of the context, they're powerful, meaningful, useful words, but I think the problem is the way they get coded. And right now, the big problem I have with the word inclusion is that essentially by saying you're including people, you're talking about, well, here's this space, and we're going to include you in it, which means you're not part of it. You're separate from it. So rather than saying what we're really talking about is how to create processes and practices that allow people to really show up, fully show up as themselves and make choices as freely as we can to show up as they want to, whether it's at work or in an organization or in their community. But the idea, I mean, I liked the shift from let's talk about diversity differently. So we're going to talk about inclusion, because that inclusion is a process. You know, it's you're including people. But again, if you're only looking at, who's not in the room, we're going to include them, then you don't really think about who's already in the room. You don't really think about
the other people are in.
Exactly, what room the other people are in. So to me, it's really interesting the words we choose. And when I hear myself using a word, and then when someone talks about the way that word sounds to them, and I go, oh, wow, I had no idea I was sending that signal. You know, the first time somebody said, well, the problem with the word inclusion is you're including people so they're not part of it, I thought I had figured out the answer to the problematic word diversity, and now I'm understanding that it's deeper than I thought. And that happens to me all the time, where I'll think about a new way to try to describe something, and then through dialogue and conversation and feedback, understand the way it's heard by others isn't the way I meant it to be heard, or it's sending a message I didn't know I was sending, so I was unconscious in some way. And I mean, I think a lot of this, I go back to talk about another word that's a buzzword that got a really bad rap, is consciousness raising. When I was nine years old, my mom was in a consciousness raising group, and so I always say my mom's consciousness was raised while mine was formed. And I know what that process was like from my perspective as a nine-year-old, and having talked to my mom as an adult about what her perspective was like. And I've had my own consciousness-raising experiences in life, and so I think about that a lot. But that definitely doesn't have the implications for people that a lot of people hear consciousness-raising, and they're like, whoa.
That's kind of groovy.
It's very groovy, and it's very woo-woo, or, you know, whatever the word
kumbaya is, I think.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that. So, but the core of it is that it's about waking up. It's about awakening. It's about realization. It's about seeing things differently. It's about growing in your understanding and evolving in your thinking. And that's something I hope continues for me, for the world, the community I'm in. I hope that continues. And however we describe it, to me, what it's really about is about getting closer to people who are different from us. And there was something else in what you said about I haven't read the book, the Zadie Smith's new book. I haven't read that yet. But it's really interesting, this idea that white people are just white, because I think that's actually a myth. And I think that's a problem. And maybe the way she's talking about it in her book, I wouldn't disagree. But when I hear about it, like the way I heard you say it, I thought, but that's not true. I mean, I'm sitting in a studio right now. There's three white women. I'm assuming we're white, skin-toned women. And I'm assuming that there's a lot of difference between us, and that the way we define being white is different, and that our histories of how we got to sit in these chairs, but also how we got to this country, how our families got to this country. I'm assuming that's all very different. And I think, I remember when I first used to do what was called diversity work back in the 90s, we would do workshops, and there would be white folks in the room who would say, well, I'm just white, I don't have a culture. You know, we would ask people to identify themselves. And a lot of times white folks wouldn't identify themselves as white, but also if they did, they didn't really identify white as their culture. But then if they started saying, well, I'm Irish American, mm-hmm. or I'm Italian American, or, you know, I'm a WASP, or I, you know, and they would have a different story, different label, that's where their culture showed up. And often we would get to that conversation by talking about, you know, how'd their family get to the U.S. or what foods did they eat at holidays? What holidays did they celebrate?
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And then their identity would show up, but it wasn't as white so much. And I think that's shifting a little bit now. At least that's my experience right now. I think more white people are identifying as white. But I think that's one of the ways in which white folks need to... there's work we need to do, because to feel what does it mean to be white is really complicated, right? And if we don't talk about it, how can we figure it out?
Well, and I wouldn't you say that our culture has been set up in order to make us same?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's perhaps what the Zadie Smith book is talking to, that among whites, there's a tendency to sort of normalize or universal, you know, the culture is a singular thing. Mm-hmm. And among blacks, that is perhaps the issue, you know, the issue for whites is the differences that lie among black and brown people. I mean, at some level. And so it's you know, there were normal schools, even, you know, there the whole idea that you're, you know, this, there's a conflict about speaking Spanish in schools, you know, that we shouldn't be teaching Spanish, we shouldn't be doing English as a second language, it should be, you know, that what we are is, you know, the melting pot is to melt into this sort of monoculture.
And I
think that those are back to your point about realizing those differences, you know, from white to white,
right.
is as important as understanding the differences that are obvious, perhaps,
yeah,
between blacks and whites, and between browns and blacks, and between browns and whites. And so it may in fact be some of the root of the discomfort, I suppose, with the Jewish population, you know, the idea that they're white like us but not like us, kind of thing. So
there's a really good book called, I think it's called, When Jews Became White, I think that's the title, but who was included in white culture in the U.S.
Right.
has changed, and that's one of the things that's fun. I find really interesting too is, you know, who got to be white, and when, and how, and the whole idea. A friend of mine who's the founder of the local chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice, Paul Garbarini, talks a lot about history. He's a public historian, but one of the things he talked to me recently about was being racialized as white. That you're racialized as white when you're treated as white and you're given privilege, white privilege, because of how you're perceived. And I think about how when I've lived in different parts of the country, who the primary other is around race lines, and whether the primary other is brown or black or Asian, or so who's the primary other. And then for a brief period of time, I lived in a neighborhood where as a white woman, I was the other. I still had white privilege, no doubt about it. But I lived in a building and in a community where, in New York City, where majority of the folks around me were Dominican Americans and immigrants. And I was the other, but I still had a lot of power. So it was really interesting because I think this idea of being other in our culture is often bound up with power, but not always.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the places I feel like it's possible to start having those quote diversity conversations in a way that doesn't get the defenses up.
Right.
Particularly for white, straight men, is when you start talking about the experience of feeling like the other. Because even if you still have male privilege, white privilege, heteronormative privilege, even if you still have those privileges, you can experience being other. And what does that feel like? And how does that shape you? And how safe or comfortable do you feel?
Excuse me.
How safe or comfortable do you feel? How powerful do you feel? How vulnerable do you feel? How backed up do you feel?
It reminds me of William Faulkner's literature, you know, where the sort of distinctions between, it was always kind of a muddying of the kind of privilege and the blacks or the mentally, you know, challenged or there was always a muddying of the water between who actually was going to, you know, the how everyone was going to survive and thrive. It's kind of a part of especially Southern literature from the, you know, the mid-20th century, I suppose, mid to late 20th century, that kind adventure or venturing into the world of the other and how that they emerge, you know, really as more dignity and than who would be assumed to be the prevailing, you know, class privileged entities.
I'm gonna have to go back and look at my high school literature class syllabus. I'm trying to remember. I think one of the things you said that in that I heard this sort of breaking expectations that
right.
You know, when someone's other or when we see them as other or when we're experiencing ourselves as being treated that way, there's a diminishment, you know. Because one of the things that when you're in the norm, we were talking earlier about that, if the norm is white, then you don't have to define that, right? You don't,
right.
You're only defining what's different. You know, that's part of the challenge with the whole term diversity is you're only defining what's not the norm. But if you don't define that norm and you don't say what makes that norm, you know, there's an unconsciousness there. and I think about the process of self awareness. That's, to me, that's one of the core stepping stones for creating any change. I mean, like, you want to try to quit smoking, you have to pay attention to, right. You know, I'm a long ago was a smoker, and I think about my attempts to quit smoking and how I failed every time I set up a system that was about other people's behavior. Like, I would tell my friends, don't let me bum a cigarette off you anymore.
Right.
And then I would bum cigarettes off of them, and they felt irritated with me or annoyed, or they didn't want to outsource my desire to quit. They were, and I was annoying because I would keep asking them, and they were like, no, if you don't want to smoke, don't smoke. But if you're going to ask me for a cigarette, I'm going to give you a cigarette. So at certain points, they all said, no, we're not going to participate in your outsourcing this. You got to own this change.
Right.
This is your change to make. You got to own it. And every time I tried to make it external, it didn't work.
Right.
And it was only when it got really deep, really core about me facing my own, not to get too melodramatic, me facing my own mortality, really, that's when I said, okay, this is not what I want to keep doing. And I think sometimes with, you know, that's a big change, but it's a little change. I mean, it's a behavior change. It's
right.
A day-to-day thing. It's an addiction, so it's not a simple thing to change. But when I think about all these other things we're trying to change in the world, you know, try to create justice and equity and affordable housing and communities that aren't divided by racism and communities that aren't divided by class. When you look at, we've got huge institutions and structures and decades and centuries of economic systems set up, built on those things. So how do we change them? And we have to recognize that they're life-threatening. We have to recognize that they are created by the externals, but also that we ourselves can make choices and do things differently to change them. And to do that, we also have to really see what's our role in it. How are we part of it? Define what it is that's happening, you know,
right.
Identify.
And it's at every turn, really.
Every single turn.
It really is. I mean, I was at a transportation event last night, and the discussion was, you know, the choices made in cities across this country to tear apart, you know, stable black neighborhoods mm-hmm. by road construction in the mid, you know, after World War II is a phenomenal blight, you know, on our spot on our history, I think. And it brings up the sort of question that Brian Stevenson, when he was here, and he had, you know, his 4 points of the sort of healing of the divisions and things, and you know, we have to get proximity.
Yep.
You know, we need, you know, there we've exhibited an amazing lack and disinterest in having proximity to people that aren't like us.
Yep.
There's discomfort in that, and to accept that. And then there's been a despair and lack of hope, but that instilling hope and holding on to hope. And there's been buy-in to the myths and a disinterest in having an alternative narrative, you know, mm-hmm. that these are things that we really have to fight against. And it's can be subtle, and what I might recognize as something that I can bring it up to someone and they don't make that connection at all. I mean,
right.
You know, I passed an older black gentleman on the street, just on King Street, right off of King Street. And said hello. I'm walking my dog or something, and his response was, "Hello, ma'am." And 10 or 20 feet away, I thought, you know, he didn't really need, you know, it was just a passing, you know, hello, and yet he referred to me, ma'am. It was either making me feel very old or
right.
Or
very white.
Are very white.
Or very female.
And a very sort of division, yeah. You know, that I'm sure had, you know, none of that. I mean, at one level, maybe, you know, at a level that was subconscious level. And
yeah,
so
I would guess it's all of it, conscious, subconscious, you know, it's habit.
Right. And do you sort of respond saying, oh, you don't have to call me ma'am, you know?
Yes.
I mean, is that the appropriate response? And I think it probably is, you know, for me it is. And
I think that's the key, is to figure out what's the appropriate response for you in that moment, what makes sense for you, what are you comfortable doing, and then to try different things. Because I think about when I first moved to Washington, D.C., which is the farthest south I had ever lived until I came to Charleston, I was not used to men opening the door or letting you out of the elevator before you. I had lived in Colorado and California, and the norms there are different. And I just didn't experience very much door holding and, you know, walk through the door before you. It just wasn't part of my experience. And when I moved to D.C. and it started happening, the first few times it happened, it really irritated me. Men would, you know, hold the door. And these were men I worked with or men I knew or not. But they would hold the door. And in my office, there were white men. There were almost always it would be one of the white men who would be opening the door and, you know, let me go through. And one time I remember saying, you don't have to do that. I really, you know, no, after you. And I did a standoff. You know, I stood there and said, no, after you. And he was like, no, after you. And I'm like, no, after you. And for me, it was because I felt like in that moment that I was being treated like a girl. Like it was a sexist reenactment. And it bothered me. But it did not have the effect I wanted. I wanted to break the pattern. And what happened was, I think it created some negative feelings with me and this colleague, because I was not, I interrupted the flow. You know, I questioned mm-hmm. something, I interrupted the flow, I raised consciousness to, but it was awkward. It wasn't a conversation. It wasn't like I sat down and I said, so talk to me about this norm, this like thing, this is how it feels to me. It wasn't a place where we got to have a conversation about it. I didn't come to understand what it meant to him. And I'm not saying that I would undo that, but what I got from that experience was this sense that there's so many little micro moments,
right,
that my interventions have to be just as constant and as effective at creating change, and that I will feel uncomfortable every time, because I still feel uncomfortable when someone opens the door for me. Generally, at this point in my life, I don't do standoffs around the door being held open. But every once in a while I think about that and I'm like, well, what is that about? And why am I participating? And what does it mean to participate? And what is it? And what would happen if I didn't participate? And what would happen if I interrupted that? And I think about that all the time, because there are times when I do have that moment of feeling irritated, because I feel like, oh God, it's that, you know, that role of women we're supposed to be taken care of, and we're supposed to be given certain things because we're especially white women, and it's very complicated. And I know that's what life is. It's all these little moments that we don't think about, and it's exhausting to think about them all the time. And at the same time, if we want to create change, I need to think about things that I think are worth changing, and then figure out how to act differently in that moment. And yet, if I'm the only one doing that, am I going to create change? In my life, maybe. For me, in my day-to-day, maybe. But I'm not going to change the behavior of all the people around me unless I'm doing it as part of a, you know, a movement. And I use that as a little example, just because I think of that as a way we reenact gender roles without even thinking about it. constantly. And it also is a way that class roles get reenacted and the racialized roles get reenacted in, you know, who goes through the door first, who holds the door for who, you know.
Well, there's
that,
there's a monument in Jackson, Mississippi, a woman seated on a pedestal, and on the pedestal on one side it says, our mothers, our daughters, our sisters, grandmothers or something. But it's huge, you know. It's a big seated woman. So if that's informative to you,
I'm gonna assume she's a white woman.
It's a stone woman. So
stone woman.
You know, it's one of those Greek-ish kind of you know, classical seated, you know, it's like alma mater at Columbia. So the maybe the holding of the door is something more the whispering of their their mother or their sister sitting on their shoulder rather than their rather than something directed at you personally.
Oh yeah, it's not sort of, that's the thing though, it's not personal at all, but it's that's almost exactly the problem,
right?
Is if it was the way we were treating each other as people, as individuals that we saw.
Right.
And it was, you know, someone saw my arms were full and they held the door for me because my arms were full. That makes some sense to me.
Right.
Or they're holding the door because, you know, they've got the longest arms and they can hold the door for the most people. Something, you know, I'm trying to think of reasons why it makes sense for, you know, hold the door for someone if they're moving more slowly, if they, you know, things like that. But often it's just gender and gender, race, age come in there that dictates who will, and I say dictate, it does dictate who will open the door and who will walk through the door and, you know, who expects it and who doesn't. And I find it so interesting because that's a little thing that happens so many times a day, and yet we reenact it, and it's a ritual, and it's a norm, and it started somewhere, and there are lots of other things like that that we all participate in without thinking, without noticing.
So this, you can go ahead and blow.
Oh, sorry. I don't think I want to. At this point, I'm like, my nose is not dripping.
Okay.
And I think that's a good thing.
So I'm going to shift sort of along the similar lines.
I keep forgetting that you're taping and that we can...
She can take it out.
We can talk about tissues and that it's really cool to see the birds.
And the bridge.
And the bridge, yeah. I was going to ask if you had the bridge view, but yeah, you do.
So we're going to shift a little bit because this brings to mind your TEDx talk about silence. And
sorry.
It's okay. She's okay. Taking notes on where these show up.
Oh, okay.
So so if we shift a little bit or really kind of carry on these along these same lines, it brings to mind the TEDx talk about silence and speaking up. And I remember hearing recently a piece on the radio. It was an interview with a Muslim woman who was a citizen of the U.S., a young woman who was conducting door-to-door polls during the election.
Oh,
and
she
was wearing hijab and found that while walking, she was constantly being subjected to various types of abuse, really abusive behavior and comments. But she also mentioned, in fact, that on occasion she had made the decision not to wear the hijab when she perceived that that environment was going to be there and, you know, that it wasn't going to be particularly welcome. This is obviously not right at some level, that where if you hold a kind of position and you feel like you're not going to be able to sort of you don't feel like you can be yourself. You know, that are we avoiding confrontation? Is that counterproductive? Or what about those individual decisions, you know, you just mentioned? And, you know, I don't make those, I don't have those confrontations anymore. I mean, you sort of decided, you know, that wasn't the kind of confrontation that was productive. And so what,
well, really,
talk to us,
me,
talk about maybe about productive confrontations versus unproductive confrontations.
Yeah, it's not that I don't have confrontations. It's more that when someone holds a door for me, I walk through the door most of the time now.
I wasn't really sliding.
Okay.
Any more than I was this woman, you know, this woman in her decision not to wear the shirt.
Yeah. No, but it's funny. I didn't even think about it as confrontations. But I think it's funny, though, that for me, that's part of it is our definition of conflict or confrontation or disruption, you know, for some, I think it's so relative, right? I think for some people, we're all discomfort, or we all experience discomfort with certain things, with certain conflicts, with, you know, but it's all different when we feel uncomfortable or what triggers the discomfort. You know, there are folks who raised voices is not a fight per se.
Right.
Or you'll say, well, we were arguing, but for somebody else, they'll hear you and they'll think you were just having a heated discussion. It was passionate, or it was, you were excited, or
right.
They'll hear emotion. They won't necessarily label it as argument, or they will hear any difference of opinion as conflict, and conflict is very uncomfortable. So I think about that range a lot, because I think that plays out a lot in when we break the rule about keeping quiet, or
which is obviously Stevenson, you know, the idea
exactly.
of having to be uncomfortable.
Exactly.
You know.
And my feeling is we're already uncomfortable. I mean, I talk about this all the time with friends. I mean, I remember before it was before I moved to Charleston, and I was talking to, I had one of those holiday family conversations where I was talking with some family members, and one of them said something that was anti-Semitic. And then later the same person said something, or she invoked the model minority myth about Asians and made a comment that I found very offensive. And we had a conversation. I asked her to, I wanted to talk to her. So I say, will you come over and talk with me about that? And I remember my feeling was, I was so upset and uncomfortable the minute she opened her mouth and said what she said, that not speaking wasn't what I was, I wasn't uncomfortable because I was speaking. I wasn't uncomfortable by what I was saying. She said something that made me uncomfortable. And
right.
So it was like, so this idea, and I talk to friends, and they'll sometimes say, yeah, you know, I just don't know what to say, and that makes me feel uncomfortable. Not knowing what to say makes me feel uncomfortable. And I think, okay, yes, it is hard not to know what to say, especially because what the person said is really where the discomfort shows up. But I think sometimes the discomfort is there before the person says something.
Right.
Because the discomfort is in some conversations, you know, especially like you have that family member, you know, they voted this way and you voted that way, or they say these things, or, you know, they have an extra drink and then they start saying stuff and it's offensive, and they, you know, they cuss more than you're comfortable, or whatever it is.
There
louder.
Was a lot of prep work on that before Thanksgiving, as
yeah.
I recall.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like that moment is the first moment.
Right.
You know, and the discomfort is there, and the expectation, that sort of the bracing yourself for what they're going to say. And I feel like so we're already uncomfortable. So the idea that we're not is one of the myths that we've got, that things are fine the way they are. They're not fine the way they are. They're not comfortable. They're not all right. things aren't all right. It's not like all of a sudden there's bad stuff showing right. up, you know? It's right. that we're seeing it for the first time, so there's a shock factor when you, you know, anytime you see or hear something or realize something that's upsetting for the first time, shock for sure, being upset, because it is literally upsetting a view. And so I understand that. It's really more, if we're already uncomfortable and we've been living with discomfort, then we're the inertia is uncomfortable, then we need to recognize that we're uncomfortable, we don't know how to do it, there is no one right way to do it.
Right.
It's not going to be easy, but it's already not easy. So I think about that. It's a lot of it's just convincing ourselves that it's okay. We've spent a lot of time, I think, saying things are fine when they're not. And it's survival, but they're not fine. So I think we need to do something. And being willing is more the issue. So for me, it's not so much we have to get uncomfortable. It's that we have to accept we are uncomfortable and be willing to take chances and change dynamics and see what happens. And because for me, you know, me saying something that might upset someone is so small a risk compared to the stakes right now.
Right.
And I think about what happens if I don't create racial justice. I mean, you know, I have nieces and nephews who are kids of color and adults of color. They're not just kids anymore. And they have children, some of them, and they're growing up in a world that's not safe for them. And if I don't do everything I can to make this world safer for them, and something happens, it's sort of somewhat ultimately selfish. How could I live with myself?
Right.
If I don't do everything I can to make a safer world, if something happens to these kids and my family,
I think that's one of the, you know, I think that's one of the things about when we live in a city or in our communities, in our neighborhoods, where we know the people who live around us, you know, it there becomes a, you know, I think we accept some responsibility, you know, by being there, to acknowledge and to, I'm not going to use the word inclusion, but I think there is that we cannot allow anyone not to feel that they're, or that they're outside, you know, that they're that it doesn't matter, you know, what they say, because I think there's been, you know, a long time of that in many of our communities, and that we didn't speak, you know, that someone didn't speak up when the road was being built through, you know, the stable or mm-hmm. you know, the stable lower income neighborhoods, and I, you know, it's there. I mean, we've covered so many of the things that I actually had sort of noted here. And I think we probably are reaching the end of our our time frame, and so I would be loath if I did not ask the question that I ask everyone who sits in that chair: what would you do if you were mayor?
It's so interesting, this question, because I had a hard time thinking about what I would say. And then I realized, well, no, you say all the time what you would do if you were mayor. I'm a member of one of the teams for CAJM, for Charleston Area Justice Ministry. A friend of mine is a House team leader and has been very involved, and I've been excited about the work and the power behind the work and the agenda that the organization committed to in terms of the social problem that CAJM wanted to change last year around community policing. And so this year, just a couple weeks ago, I was at a meeting where there were a couple things that were discussed specifically around police stops of pedestrians and folks on bikes in North Charleston and in Charleston. And in both cities, it's disproportionately the police are disproportionately stopping African Americans,
right?
On and when they do pedestrian and police stop pedestrians or people on their bikes, disproportionate. And Kajum has asked our mayor to embrace an independent audit of the police department, and the audit that the mayor has embraced is a financial audit, which is, I think, the narrowest definition of the word. And while that's a really good thing, and I'm glad to see that, I wholeheartedly agree that we need to, that our police departments need to be audited independently for processes, procedures, to look for racial discrimination, but also other patterns and processes that may be problematic. And I think this is something I would say no matter where I was in the country, because in most places that's not happening. There are some cities where that is happening. But that to me is a really clear thing that I think I would like to see our mayor do, that if I were mayor, I would do. Because I think feedback is critical, and that's a great way to get it. And I strongly support any effort to build the bonds between institutions that are supposed to serve the community, like police or firefighters or any city office, you know, public health. I strongly support the efforts to connect and build communication and relationships between those institutions and community members.
Right.
But you build trust, you earn trust. It's without trust, without relationships, you have to invest in it. And information is, I think, critical to building trust and being honest and saying, here's what's happening. Here, the data are showing us things. The data are telling
right.
us things. And if there's an unwillingness to look at more data or to gather more data or to get data that's coming from a trusted third party, independent, to me that's problematic, because then it almost says we're not willing to look at even to get data. And
well,
that's a problem.
I interviewed Kendra Stewart, who's at the College of Charleston. They do a lot of data kinds of things. And she made an interesting, what seems now in retrospect, a very obvious, she made the observation, you know, that in order to reach communities of color, for instance, you know, their perception, the perception of police between a black person and a white person, just in a single encounter with an officer, is very different.
Completely.
And and until we acknowledge,
that's right,
that is you know, ever present.
That's,
I mean,
right.
How can you even sort of begin to take next steps? So
And it's one of those things that this is where I talk to white folks. And I'll say, so think about going through your day-to-day and think about any interaction you have with an official or a salesperson or whoever, and say, that happened because I'm white. Just start filling that in, because some of the time that's true. So I had an experience where I was speeding, and the entire experience I had with the police officer, who was a white man, was shaped by me being a white middle-aged woman.
Right.
Completely shaped by that. And I was conscious of it the whole time. I didn't say to him in the middle of that, you're treating me this way because I'm a middle-aged white woman. But I was very conscious of how different the experience I was having was from the experience my friends of color have.
Right.
And the experiences that white men who are younger than me have had.
Right.
And so I was very conscious of it. And I think it's important for all of us to start thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
But you're absolutely right. I used to train police officers on domestic violence and on hate crimes, and this was in Colorado in the 90s. And I was training them specifically around LGBT community members and our perceptions and experiences of hate crimes, and also our experiences with the police. Because, you know, many of the people I served, their memory included being harassed by police for being at a gay bar. So I talked to the police and said, so you have to realize, when you go to investigate a crime, a hate crime against a gay person, part of what's going on for them is you could be a perpetrator in their mind, because they know someone who was harassed by police, who was kicked out of a bar, who was harassed, who was arrested, who was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So the community we talk to each other. So we know that. So our trust level is different, and it's based on our real experiences.
Right.
And the experiences of people we care about and know. And so that's part of why I think it's really important for this independent data to show up and say, so I may look at the police and have had different experiences with the police than someone who's African American, than someone who's a young man, white man, young black man. And as a white middle-aged woman, my experience is shaped in part by that. And so to recognize that is really critical. And I think data that over and over again, the data show these perceptions are different.
Right.
Even if people disagree with what's happening, they can't disagree that the perceptions are there.
Right.
You know, so, and that's part of what I like about the data is that it says, look, we're not talking about.
We didn't make this up.
No, we're not talking about, you know, some. This is how I see you. This right. is what happens. And the reason is here. And I think having those data are so critical,
yeah.
especially from an independent source, because, you know, then it's everyone's looking in the same mirror.
Right. Right.
It's not a fun house.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for joining us this week, Kat. And
thank you. Thank you, for having me.
Oh, absolutely. And in even a little bit sick, I'm sorry. But we've come to realize that through the If You Were Mayor engagement process, we've come to realize that an investment in community really begins with engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many ways that people can engage in this topic about empowerment and the Charles Neri Justice Ministry is certainly one, and it leverages the voices of especially people that come out of the area churches. People can get involved either through their church, they can tag along with somebody. I know that's encouraged. And there are several other groups, the Quality Education Project, Charleston Good, Charleston Engaged.
Showing up for racial justice, right. which is folks can find
right.
us online, Charleston Showing Up for Racial Justice. It's a national network, but we're the local chapter.
Oh, great.
Founded by my friend I mentioned earlier, Paul Garbarini, who our focus is really as a national movement to mobilize white folks against racism. So it's really to build the ally muscle, if you will, or the co-conspirator.
That's great.
Yeah, white anti-racists. That's what Surge is about.
Well, I would also encourage everyone listening to note March 21st on your calendar. That is the date when journalist and National Book Award winning author Ta-Nehisi Coates has been rescheduled to speak as part of the Race and Social Justice Initiative of the Avery Research Center at the College of Charleston. And that wraps up this episode of Small Talks, Big Ideas with If You Were Mayor. And again, which is pretty much monthly. We invite you to go along to our Facebook page, and you can submit questions, feedbacks, ideas. We post these programs on our website if you're looking for past programs, and this one will actually come up if you miss the broadcast. You can tell your friends they can catch it on, or if you just need a refresher, you can listen to it again. Next week, you can tune in to Small Talks, Big Ideas for your chance to hear Low Country Local First, and thank you for tuning in to 96.3 FM Ohm Radio Charleston and supporting your local nonprofit radio station. Thank you very much.
Thank you.